We from Kaveri Hospital Alvarpet Chennai and Epicenter Chennai are proud to launch the Epicenter Physician Education Initiative. This will be a series of YouTube videos where people who are practicing medicine or in the paramedical field will be better able to understand and practice the field of epileptology. The idea behind this initiative is to train physicians who are often the first port of call when a person gets a seizure to be able to better take care of the patients. With this, we hope that everyone who is interacting with any patient with epilepsy, who is responsible for their medical care, will be able to do a better job. This is the first of the series, and today we are going to discuss the epilepsy basics, the classification, the types and the causes. Before we start, we have to understand that epilepsy is the second commonest neurological condition globally. And this puts a considerable burden not only on individuals, on the community, but also the healthcare systems. Globally, there are 50 million people with epilepsy. And it is estimated that 1/6 of this population lives in India. So we are talking about 10 to 12 million people in India who suffer from epilepsy. So there is a real need that everybody who faces a patient with epilepsy is able to recognize and do their best to take care of such patients. A very unfortunate event is also that a considerable number of patients do not get appropriate treatment, and this is called the treatment gap. So what does it do to us as medical professionals? We have a responsibility to reduce the treatment gap, and every one of us has a role to understand, diagnose and recognize epilepsy so that we are able to give the appropriate treatment and create hope in the lives of these patients. Within the Southeast Asia region itself, 2 to 10 per 1,000 population have epilepsy. And there is a big burden from India. And it is assumed that this burden is because of our large population, our lower income and education, various socio-cultural prejudices, inadequate resources, competing infectious and non-communicable diseases, and a very low importance which is given by public health for aspects of epilepsy. The International League Against Epilepsy has revised its conceptual definition of epilepsy to an operational definition to bring concordance with common usage. So, I will be giving you three statements which are actually the definition of epilepsy. And if a patient fulfills those criteria, he or she may be considered to have a diagnosis of epilepsy. The first one is the person has at least 2 unprovoked or reflex seizures occurring 24 hours apart. The second criteria is 1 unprovoked or reflex seizure and a probability of further seizures similar to the general recurrence risk of at least 60% after 2 unprovoked seizures occurring over the next 10 years. And thirdly, the diagnosis of an epilepsy syndrome. Let me explain the second point once more. When you get 1 unprovoked seizure following 2 recurrent seizures and a chance of it recurring again and again, that is what that second point actually is highlighting. And that incidence of a second seizure after two unprovoked seizures could be anywhere from immediate to 10 years. Epilepsy syndromes are syndromes where there is other brain damage, other symptoms of neurological symptoms together with epilepsy. Let us look at the demographics of epilepsy. When we look at the age distribution of epilepsy, we find that in the first decade and in the 70s and 80s, there is a bimodal peak. And there have been several studies by Hauser et al., Mani et al., Banerjee et al., where this has been confirmed. In children, the prevalence rate is 2 per 1,000 and it can be as high as 22 per 1,000. The reason for this is perinatal injury, newborn distress, head trauma, hypoglycemia at birth, malnutrition, and neurocysticercosis, especially in countries like India and Brazil. When we go to the gender, epilepsy seems to have a preponderance for males over females. More males suffer from epilepsy than females. Radhakrishnan et al. Reported a prevalence of 5.2 per 1,000 for males and 4.7 per 1,000 for females. Gauri Devi's statistics say 6.1 per 1,000 for males and 5.2 for females. In general, we know that there is at least a 1% increase in males over females. When we look at the age at which it occurs in males and females, men who are younger seem to be more predisposed to get epilepsy, and women who get epilepsy seem to be a little in the older age group. A very important fact for us to take note of is that among the females, especially in India, we have 2.73 million women with epilepsy, and 52% of them belong to the reproductive age group, which puts a tremendous responsibility on our obstetricians, gynecologists, and all those who are taking care of women in their childbearing years through pregnancy and through various other conditions, to take special care that some of the risk factors which I've mentioned up to now do not occur in these women, because it puts them at a higher risk for getting epilepsy. When we look at urban versus rural differences, there is a clear increase in rural areas over urban areas. There was a study called the Burn study from Bangalore, and it showed 2 times higher prevalence in rural areas compared to urban areas. And this may be because of poorer resources and poorer reporting when they have epilepsy. So in the urban-rural differences, there are social issues, but there are also possible reasons due to lack of facilities for good antenatal and postnatal care, due to more birth injuries, malnutrition, infections of the systemic and central nervous system, higher incidence of head injuries, and limited services in the rural areas. Also, infections like neurocysticercosis seem to be more in the rural areas than in the urban areas. When we look at other socio-economic correlates, we find that the incidence of epilepsy is much higher in certain groups of people. When there has been birth trauma, when there has been neonatal infection, poor nutrition, poor hygiene, and poor health-seeking behavior, the risk of epilepsy and its outcome is poorer. Across the globe, a lower socio-economic status, low income, and less education are regarded as risk factors for epilepsy. It is very important for us to be able to classify epilepsy properly. The classification of epilepsy over the years has undergone several changes. But the latest classification by the International League Against Epilepsy in 2019 took into consideration five elements. One, the ictal semiology. Is it focal or is it generalized? Two, the seizure type. Here again, is the seizure occurring with loss of awareness or without loss of awareness? The epilepsy syndrome. And fourthly, the etiology of epilepsy. And fifth, the degree of impairment during the seizure. This is highlighted in the diagram which is shown to you. And you will see that together with this, we have to consider comorbidities. So our seizure types are focal, generalized or unknown. Among the generalized, you may have a combination of generalized with focal and you have unknown types. And all of these can have the etiology, which could be structural, genetic, infectious, metabolic, immune and unknown. The classification is extremely important because our treatment is tailored to the type of seizure that we are seeing. So when we see a focal seizure, there are certain drugs which typically work for focal seizures and do not help control generalized seizures. Vice versa is also true. Also, there are some drugs used for focal seizures which are contraindicated in some types of generalized seizures. An important point to remember when we are classifying and diagnosing a person to have epilepsy is to remember that epilepsy is chronic recurrent seizures. Now, acute symptomatic seizures can occur due to various causes. So this is not epilepsy. And so the general physician usually is likely to be the first and probably the only person to see acute symptomatic seizures when they occur. They are events which occur in close temporal relationship to an acute nervous system insult. This insult may be metabolic, toxic, structural, infectious, or due to inflammation. They differ from epilepsy in many ways. There is an underlying neurological insult. The temporal sequence of the seizure closely follows the neurological insult. There is a biological basis very often as the cause. And acute symptomatic seizures are identifiable as long as the primary neurological insult is active. And usually they settle down once the primary insult is defeated or overcome. And they are not necessarily likely to be prone for chronic recurrence. So overall, acute symptomatic seizures has a better prognosis. And the etiology can be following brain injury, following hypoxia to the brain, malnutrition, infection in the mother during pregnancy, head injuries, metabolic conditions. When there is a family history of antecedent epilepsy, when there is a prior history of febrile seizures, when there is birth complicated by in labor, and when there are seizures in the neonatal period, these are all predictors of possible future epilepsy. So it's important for us to understand that during a meningitis, during a head injury, seizures may occur just for a short time. These are called acute symptomatic seizures. In general, what are the predisposing neurological conditions which can lead to epilepsy? All infections of the nervous system can show up with acute symptomatic seizures. So meningitis due to any cause, bacterial, viral, encephalitis, meningoencephalitis, meningitis, tuberculosis of the central nervous system, dengue fever, malaria, HIV. So any number of infections can predispose to acute symptomatic seizures. Now, what is the importance of acute symptomatic seizures and its relationship to an infection? Very often after this infection, not because the acute symptomatic seizure is recurring, but due to the pre-existing brain damage which occurs due to the neurological insult, these people can develop epilepsy in later life and get recurrent seizures as secondary epileptic seizures. So the commonest conditions which predispose to these secondary epileptic seizures are neurocystic psychosis, neuroinfections, and head injury. Neurocystic psychosis is commonly diagnosed in India, and it is an infection due to the tapeworm. There is a encysting of the skull of the tapeworm larva in the brain, and this often presents as a solid isolated granuloma and presents with a seizure. This is not typically an acute symptomatic seizure, but it's not typically an epilepsy either. And very often the treatment for this is usually only treating the seizure. Sometimes when the lesion is big, we have to treat the neurocystic psychosis as well. Neurotrauma leaving behind epilepsy is common, but very often we only diagnose epilepsy after head injury if the polytrauma has caused immediate seizures. It is not epilepsy, it's post-traumatic seizure, but we call it post-traumatic epilepsy if the seizures recur more than 1 year after the head injury. There are many metabolic conditions which may accompany brain tumors and other metabolic conditions like low calcium, sodium, and blood sugar. Electrolyte and fluid imbalance due to diarrhea, inborn errors of metabolism like phenylketonuria, amino acidurias. These are all risk factors in infancy and childhood. Birth injury, brain infections. In the elderly, stroke can very often be a common cause of seizures. There can be hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia, uremia, hyponatremia, hypocalcemia. These are all very common metabolic derangements which can provoke seizures. If we look at the natural history of epilepsy, we find that it varies widely. But in general, we know that if a patient is untreated, or if while on treatment they keep getting repeat seizures, such patients, their outcome and prognosis is not very good. But many studies have shown us that when the seizures are just few and far between and they respond to treatment with anti-epileptic drugs, 70% of patients with treatment over 3 to 5 years can be made seizure free, and many of them can actually get off the anti-epileptic drug over time. So in spite of its varied etiology, there is a lot of hope in more than 70% of patients with epilepsy for them to recover from the seizure. One thing I want you all to remember is that in epilepsy, we still are often not treating the cause of epilepsy. We are very often not treating the primary cause for which is producing the epileptic seizure. In many cases, we do not know the cause. But when we control seizures, that itself seems to protect the brain and also prevent recurrent seizures and help them to overcome epilepsy. I hope you found this session useful to get a very preliminary and basic understanding about the concepts of epilepsy, in whom they occur, how they occur, why they occur, and what are the differential diagnoses that we need to keep in mind when we see a patient for the first time. So we will be following this up with a series of videos, and I welcome you and invite you to keep watching them so that your knowledge of epileptology grows and we are all committed to take better care of our people with epilepsy so that they can live a full life with everyone, like everyone, in spite of epilepsy. Thank you for your attention.